So good evening, everybody. I'm very happy to introduce today Danny Dorling, our last speaker of the lecture series in Health Inequalities. So Danny Dorling studied geography, mathematics and statistics and did a PhD in visualization of spatial social structure. So something different to the speakers that we have heard before. He has been a professor in human geography at the University of Sheffield for almost 10 years and other positions as well, and is now a professor of geography at the University of Oxford. And he has also been awarded many prizes that I don't want to list now, but I'm just very happy to hear today his presentation on an international perspective on health inequalities in rich countries.
Thank you. Can you hear me at the back okay?
Thank you. Okay, so you started off in October with Johan Mackenbach about inequalities, and then you had Ritu Sundana about ageing, Nicola Bachmann about Switzerland, and then Thomas Abel about the fundamental importance of cultural capital. And we're back to inequality today with me. I'm going to talk for 36 minutes, and then I will stop and get you to ask me questions. I also want you to look into something for me, because in the last couple of years, probably the biggest disaster in health in Europe has occurred since the Second World War, and nobody is quite sure why it's occurred as it's occurred. The kind of questions we've got up here are, why are babies in the United States still several times more likely to die in their first year of life than in the best off parts of Europe or East Asia? Why is life expectancy so closely correlated with economic inequality? Why is older age mortality still improving so quickly in Norway, Finland and Japan, but it's actually going down in the USA and the UK at the moment? And how does increased economic uncertainty and precarity affect your mental health? I'm going to show you a load of pictures and tell you a few stories. So please store up any questions. A few years ago, this was the kind of thing that got people worried. It's a very crude diagram showing WHO figures on infant mortality along the y-axis and inequality measured by a ratio of the best off 10th to the worst off 10th on the x-axis. And it kind of implies that the more unequal a country, the lower the chances of survival for babies. The chances are incredibly good. These are incredibly low infant mortality rates, but there appears to be a rough relationship here. The really interesting thing on these diagrams, by the way, are the outliers. And Switzerland is your outlier there. The data gets better. Sorry, not Switzerland. Singapore. Switzerland will be an outlier later, don't worry. You can read the text about Texas and about healthcare, I won't go through that. But I think if you look at that graph, you'll see that the more unequal a country, in this case we're measuring inequality of how much the 1% took in 1983, the higher the infant mortality is measured most recently. The interesting thing here is that it's inequality in 1983, but these babies were only born a few years ago. States in the United States, countries of Europe, tend to keep their rank order of inequality. It doesn't change that much. Places which treat people who are poorer well and don't allow a few people to take a lot of money tend to manage to carry on doing that decade after decade. But the rates have tended also to go up. Singapore, in case you don't know the story of Singapore, Singapore is one of the countries with one of the lowest rates of infant mortality in the world. It doesn't boast about having the lowest rate of infant mortality in the world, and the reason it doesn't boast about it is, despite the fact that it has incredibly good healthcare systems, very good hospital, it also pregnancy tests all 100,000 maids every 3 months. So that if you are a maid working in Singapore and you are pregnant, you are deported. this is one of the best ways to avoid people becoming pregnant, or to encourage them to have an abortion if they become pregnant, to keep their job. If you don't allow the poorest people in your society to have children, your infant mortality rate will improve. But it's nothing to be proud of. That's why I said the outliers are interesting. Here's life expectancy. Now, you wouldn't expect the relationship with life expectancy to be as good as infant mortality, because life expectancy is affected by many things that occur over the whole course of your lifetime, some of which have nothing to do with inequality. The most obvious is smoking. Have we got anybody from Denmark here? Quiet, shy Danes? No. That's the case. The Danes did us a great service in public health. For years they carried on smoking at a higher rate than everybody else in Europe, and helped prove that it doesn't matter how nice you are and how lovely you are and how much you hug each other, smoking still kills you. Young Danes have actually reduced their smoking now, so it's going to no longer be an experiment. But there are many other reasons. But in general, you can see that kind of relationship. And we've just taken inequality at one point, 1983. All the countries for which there was data in 1983 are included here. You don't fix these graphs by fixing the data, that's a stupid thing to do. I chose 1983 because it's the earliest date we can get good inequality data for. But if you want to be cleverer, you can use more up-to-date information, or you could just use the Gini coefficient or the 10 to 10 ratio. Lots of different things, you'll get the same relationship. The graph top right, as far as you're looking, is showing the Netherlands and Switzerland's trend over time in terms of how much the 1% take. The 1% take, that is what proportion of national income the best off 1% of people get every year, is my favourite inequality measure. Partly because it's very simple, it's not that hard to calculate, it's not like trying to explain a Gini coefficient or anything, but also it's beginning to emerge that of the various different ways in which we can measure inequality, the take of the 1% may be the most important. Or put it another way, when the elite of your country have lives that are more similar to everybody else, your country tends to be better organised. And the take of the 1% is one way of indicating how the elite are different. The 1% in Switzerland take half as much as the 1% in the UK. We're talking bankers. This is all bankers now when you're in the 1%. Swiss bankers take half as much as British bankers. Amazingly, they carry on deciding to work and live in Switzerland rather than fly into London to take a job. The suggestion here is that because your bankers aren't taking as much as London bankers, you're in a country in Switzerland that is better organised, where the people at the top are less ignorant. People at the bottom. The little graph at the bottom is showing the rise of maternal mortality in Texas when there were cuts to the funding of clinics. There are always thousands of reasons, direct reasons ending up with biological reasons, as to why a badly organized country has higher mortality rates. But underlying the reasons, it tends to be inequality. Unequal countries are more likely to think it's okay to cut maternity services. The top graphs there are from the official survey used in the UK to measure people's subjective well-being when it comes to health. So it's the one that the Office of National Statistics use to gauge how well people say they are. And you'll see from 2010, 11, 12, 13, 14, the population of the United Kingdom repeatedly saying that their health was getting less and less satisfactory. The map I've put up there is the map of the vote for Brexit. It's one of the maps that currently obsesses us in the United Kingdom. It's a fascinating map because it's not like any other map of the UK. But the suggestion is that part of the reason why the UK was the first country after Greenland to vote to leave the EU was that things were going badly wrong in the United Kingdom. Inequality in the United Kingdom was higher than anywhere else in Europe. When austerity hit after 2010 and when the cuts came in, people said that their health was getting worse. They weren't believed. You don't believe people when you ask them a subjective question. Then they started dying in high numbers. But still the authorities in Britain say the two things are unconnected, and it was the flu. They said it was the flu in 2012, and the flu in 2013, and the flu in 2014. And then again, when lots of people died in 2015, they said it was the flu again. This is a special kind of flu that goes on and on and on. Right? Unlike the normal epidemics we've ever had before, which tend to be short and over the course of a month. This is the country I live in and come from, where I discovered yesterday that the last chief medical statistician was employed until 2008, and we no longer have a government official qualified to look at the medical statistics of the United Kingdom. But it could be worse. The lovely thing about being in the UK is that we have somewhere to look at across the Atlantic where everything when it comes to health is worse, and dramatically worse. We might be bad, but boy, do they take the biscuit. The way in which, in case any of you, apologies if you're from America, I should try not to be more condescending, but if you are from America and you're going to go back to America and you're going to teach health statistics, the way to do it is this. You ask your undergraduates to write you an essay about why the United States has the best health in the world. You look completely serious when you do this and you send them off to the library to write that essay. And they trust you and they like you. And then they find it hard. If you were to tell an audience of US undergraduates about the actual record of the USA, they, for obvious and natural reasons, will begin to suspect you and your motives. It's not the way to do it. This graph was produced in The Economist magazine. It was the highest correlation they could find to the change in the Republican voting that helped Trump get into office. There's a correlation with health getting worse in counties. There are about 3,300 counties in the United States, and those counties which are on a basket of health measures saw the health get worse, saw the biggest swings towards Trump. This is not individuals whose health got worse, this is people living in counties whose health got worse. We know who the individuals are who voted for Trump. We know they are more often men, and they're white, and they're fairly well off. But they were men who are white, who are fairly well off, living in areas that they saw go downhill around them. Very similar to the UK, where the people who voted for Brexit were not the poorest. They were actually what we call the four middle deciles. Not the poorest 30% of the country, not the richest, certainly 30%. But the middle 40% of the UK voted more Brexit than anybody else. It was poor Conservatives, a bit like poor Republicans, who are never as poor as people who don't vote or people who vote more left-wing. We're going to speed up. This is the 2015 event in the UK by age. In absolute numbers, the biggest rises in mortality were for people aged over 90, so nobody cared because they're over 90, but it was there, 85 to 89, 80, 75 to 79, 70 to 74. More elderly people started to die a few years younger. Here's the relative changes. And the really interesting thing here is that for a few children we actually saw falls, but also for this 25 to 29 age group. While everybody else mortality was rising, this group was still getting better in UK recently. And it isn't just the UK, I'm going to show you data for a whole series of countries across Europe soon. What's special about the age 25 to 29 cohort in the UK is the age of biggest net in-migration. 60,000 young adults a year of those ages come into the UK. Migrants are healthy. Migrants almost always are healthier than the population they come into. And they showed this in this data. How many of you have seen a population cartogram before? That's a map stretched by population. It should be low. Put your hands up if you have. One, two, three, four, okay. So this is, I'm going to have to spend half a minute explaining this map. Normal maps are not much used for epidemiology, or for study, or for showing voting, or for much that's about people. Because normal maps make land area equal to the area on the page, and most of the land area is empty of people, it's mountains or it's sea. Here, the map is stretched so that everybody gets an equal amount of space on the map. So this is London. This is Paris. This is Madrid. This is the Costa del Sol. This is Switzerland. Right, now look at the key. Switzerland is interesting for many reasons. This is Greece, and most of Greece is Athens. When people talk about a Greek financial crisis, they're talking about one city. Okay, so you've got an idea what the map is showing you. Everywhere is still connected to all the places it should be. We've just stretched it so we're no longer looking at the places where nobody lives. And the shading scheme is the proportion of people living in that area who are born in another country. Dark blue is over 20%. Many parts of Switzerland have over 20%. Being in the middle of a continent helps. Being long and thin as an area increases your proportions of migrants. Switzerland couldn't survive without its migrants. But the same for Paris, without some of its migrants, the same for Spain, and the same for London. Ireland, of course, has people moving that way and that way, but also coming from over here into there. Most of the north of England is yellow, same colour as most of Eastern Europe, which is less than 5% of people born in another country. The parts of Britain that voted to leave were the parts of Britain with the fewest immigrants. The people who are most scared of immigrants are the people who don't get to experience much immigration. The one great news about Brexit, I'll try not to go on about it much more, is that Britain is going to suddenly discover how much it needs immigrants, and that immigrants were not its problem. This is IMF data showing the proportion of GDP that's spent on public services in different countries and the change over time. We have a huge natural experiment going on, where different countries are now doing things very differently, and we can begin to measure the outcomes. The bad news is that we only have one planet. This is only bad news if you're a statistician. If we had 20 planets with 25 rich countries on, then we'd be able to get the degree of variance low enough that you could actually prove these things. But with only one planet, we can't. It's history rather than mathematics. But the point of this is look at the differences. There's Finland. Finland shows it is possible to spend 57% of your GDP on public services and society doesn't collapse. The schools are somewhat good in Finland. Right? People still drink too much in Finland, although that's going down. There was quite a lot of variety back in 2002, 2003. All of this is a spending to stop the banks crashing. Ireland took the advice of the British. It was very, very, very bad advice. And they decided to bail out every last bank account. Hence Ireland is now down here. But the UK is here. Japan is here. The USA is here. And the USA position isn't quite as good as that because a very large amount of public spending in the USA is on a very large army and a very big arsenal of nuclear weapons. But we've got them in the UK. Apart from France, all those other lucky countries aren't spending that amount of money. And you can begin to look at the outcomes of places and what happens. When the economic crisis hit in 2008, some countries increased their taxation so that the public services didn't have to get worse. Places like the UK did the opposite. We actually reduced taxation, so our GDP fell. And then the proportion of the GDP we spent on public services also fell. We tried to protect National Health Service, which is the lowest funded health service in at least Western Europe. Here, you spend twice as much per person on health than they spend in the UK. Double. It's an incredible difference. You have, I think, the highest health spending per head in Europe. And as yet, things are kind of working here. I find this interesting. At some point, there has to be a country that becomes too equal, spends too much on public services. As yet, nobody has done that to actually show some negative effect of doing so. This is parochial, but it's a kind of graph you need to understand the next graphs. Along the y-axis, we've got the measure of something, in this case, far-right voting in the United Kingdom. And on the x-axis, we've got the change, the rate of change in that. And I'm going to show you this in a minute for mortality that you'll be more interested in. But far-right voting, we had a bit of it in 1997, goes low, comes up, goes low, goes up in 2009, goes low, goes all the way up here in 2014. It's now down to 1% again. I haven't added the latest data. Right down to there. What the graph is showing is how you can wind a country up to vote in a particular way, in this case the United Kingdom, was wound up to vote for particular parties at particular times and then for Brexit. One more of these election graphs. This is the popularity of the Labour Party, which is now the biggest political party in Europe. In May 2015, it was sitting at about 33%. It elects Jeremy Corbyn in this mess. It cascades down and down and down and down, becoming as unpopular as you've ever been. Just about 26% of people said they'd vote for Labour. Theresa May goes walking. She may have come walking here. I forgot where she went walking. But Theresa May, our Prime Minister, goes for a walk. Her officials tell her you have to call an election. Nobody ever loses an election when the opposition are down there. And that was true. She calls an election, and then this thing happens. You have to take my word for it, I could show you thousands of these graphs. This thing has never happened before. The biggest, fastest swing and change of opinion of the British public ever as measured in any election. That's why the Conservatives don't have a majority in Britain. So strange things are happening in voting, in economics, in housing, all kinds of things are weird. Okay, so back to health, much more simple. Here you've got life expectancy, male and female average, just the total life expectancy, data from Eurostat, going up to around just over 81 years of age. And here you've got the change in life expectancy from the year before to the year after the year being shown. If any of you have seen these graphs before, please tell me. I don't think people draw graphs like this. But it is. I think it's useful. I don't think it's, well, compared to those weird maps, this is more simple. So UK life expectancy in 93 was about 76. It rises 76.5, it's rising about half a year, rises 77. It's rising by about a fifth of a year, kind of wanders around until 2008, 2009. Then the rises slow down, still rising. You hit that line and you're falling. Okay, fall's not big, but when you're over here on that side of the line, it's going down. And this is the event, back. Okay, that's the event we want to know about. And what we want to know, and I've got guesses, obviously, and I'm opinionated, but I'm worried, because I've got old enough to know I can make mistakes. So if any of you want to look into this over the next couple of years, you are just as qualified as any of the great epidemiologists in Europe to do it, because they've never seen this before either. Finland. What the hell is going on in Finland that it hasn't been touched by this? Did that influenza not get to Finland at all? Not one person? What were they doing in Finland? That it's as if the crash never happened. Now, I gave you a clue earlier when I showed you their public spending rising. But it can't just be that. But Finland, you're looking at 82. You're still going up, you know, a fifth to a quarter of a year. We're already higher than the UK. UK, by the way, is the worst in Europe that we've measured. But Germany's not great. Although Germany is much more recent. It's 2014. We don't have data yet for 2016. Part of me thinks you can't take in 1 million people from Syria very, very quickly and that not have an effect. But remember, migrants are healthy. And the middle class who got out to Syria first were healthier, but still, I don't know. And somebody needs to look, somebody may have looked. But I haven't seen any reports yet to say what's going on in Germany. And believe me, before this, before 93, you didn't see anything like this. Apart from, well, not in West Germany. You did in the Eastern Lander, and we've seen this before in Russia. Okay, 89, 90, 91, 92. But we don't know. Norway, nothing. Nothing at all. Again, it's on the edge of Europe. Maybe the flu found it hard to get to Norway. Flu is still the official reason, the only official reason that a government official in Britain has ever given. And the flu observation centres really want to say it's flu because they get paid to be flu observation centres. That's the problem with advocacy. If you pay people to analyse a particular cause of disease, they will find it. That's why the WHO did its big exercise of saying people can only die once. So you can't claim that all your things are killing all of them because you end up with more people dying than the number of people that there are. Spain. So it's happened in Spain, but again, more recently and not as bad as the UK, but we don't know why. There has been austerity, of course, in some of these countries, and there has been fairly nasty austerity in Spain, people being locked out of houses. Sweden, a hint of something happening, right? It stays still, it doesn't go up anymore. France, not good. Not as bad as the UK, not good, and doesn't have the excuse for 1 million Syrian refugees. Well, there are quite a lot of Syrian refugees. Denmark does better, but still no longer rising in 2015. Italy does badly, Netherlands not so badly. Switzerland, I added this. My software won't put the dates on anymore. But there we go. So it's happened here, but it's very small. And Ireland, nothing. So perhaps peripheral countries, perhaps it's a flu that is just tipping places, but you know, there isn't some amazing new strain of flu that is killing, in the case of Britain, 120,000 people in the last 5 years. Paper published in BMJ Open, 10 authors recently. Here's the inequality curve for the UK. High inequality, very low when I was a child, very high again, at 8.1%. Across the rich world, everywhere was this unequal. In the 1920s, almost everywhere came down to something like this in the 1960s, and then they all went different ways. So we have an actual experiment about inequality. I'm going to show you league table from 2010, which is still roughly correct. This is comparing the average, the mean average, not the median, the mean average income of the best off 10th, which is incredibly influenced by the rest of 1%, to the mean average income of the poorest 10th in each country. And of the richest 25 countries in the world with at least 2 million people, Japan is the most equal, followed by Finland, Norway, Sweden. Then it was Germany, Austria, Slovenia, South Korea, Denmark, Belgium, and Switzerland. Average European country for inequality. Then France, the Netherlands, Ireland, Canada, Greece, Spain, Italy, New Zealand, Australia, Israel, and above Israel, the United Kingdom, used to be Portugal, that's now gone, United States, and then Singapore. So that's the variety of inequalities we have, and these ratios are big. You're living parallel lives. You're in the best tenth, you're talking about how many holidays do you have a year? 2 holidays, 3, 6, 10? Little skiing trip, getaway at Easter, another little one at Christmas, 2 holidays in the summer. Half the children in Britain have no holiday a year. None. You have to be kind of careful how you find that out. If you ask a child at the end of summer if they've had a summer holiday, they'll say yes. Because children have learned not to embarrass themselves. So you ask their parents more subtly and you find that half don't. Here's the latest data. It's very similar. It's just that the crash in Portugal has taken Portugal out of that top group. And I'll just leave it up for a minute if you want to read all the nerdy stuff. I'm only going to talk for 8 more minutes, so please think of questions for me. I've been looking at inequality for many years, and I probably think it's more important than it is. But I'm coming to think it's not actually the inequality per se. It's not the inequality of itself. Although that is bad, it makes you behave in all kinds of strange ways. The rate of inequality that your country has, that the society you live in has, is a measure of how badly it is organised. When you organise a society badly, you allow a few people who are quite greedy to take more and more and more, and things start to go wrong. When you organise a society well, you can control the greedy. There will always be greedy people. You might actually need greedy people. After all, we've evolved to have greedy people. If greedy people were entirely disastrous, we would have, you know, let them go off into the wilderness and have died off long ago. Right? We've all got binocular vision. We haven't let people who didn't have binocular vision kind of survive. All women go through the menopause. Anyway, the greedy are always going to be with us. The point is, countries which are good at doing things like organising public transport and healthcare and making it so that you can cycle and that the schools are good and fair are also countries that are good at stopping the top 10% and 1% taking more and more. And there are also countries that are good at making sure the health of the population is well looked after. And there are also countries where people care about other people. If you want an image, a single image of the difference between Japan and the United States, think about what happened after Hurricane Katrina in the United States, the National Guard sitting on the edge of helicopters with their guns over New Orleans, and the reaction in Japan to the tsunami. Now, this isn't cultural. Japan was more unequal to the United States in the 1930s. People in Japan held other people in very low regard because it was an aristocratic country. The Americans invaded Japan and made it the most equal country on the planet. Not because the Americans wanted to create a national experiment. The Americans were worried that there was going to be a communist revolution in Japan in 45-46. So they took land off the aristocracy and they gave people as equal amount of land as they could. And you then see the result in how people react to a tsunami, which was, how can we help these people as fast as possible because these people are just like us. And you think people are just like you when you're paid similar amounts. But when you're not paid similar amounts, no matter how nice you are and how much you give to charity and all the rest of it, you slowly don't begin to think those people as quite like you, because it isn't possible to. You can't operate if you do. Other things. Just going to show you a few other things and then I'll conclude your education at the Connected. People often say that inequality is needed because it makes you entrepreneurial and it helps business and so on. Never without any data. This is patents per head. And you'll see this in the more equal countries of the rich world, people are more inventive. I could do the same for scientific papers per head, but it's high. Again, outliers, Switzerland. You can guess which industry it is in Switzerland. Yeah. I'd love to know why, because the outlier is always weird, you know. Is there some special government deal that makes the pharmaceutical companies really want to be here? Anyway, you look at the outliers, but in general, you know, the level of entrepreneurialism and invention in Mississippi is not high, right? Whereas the level in Finland, just think phones, think Wi-Fi, think invented, it's not a big country, is high. More equal countries do tend to be a bit more boring, I'll give you that. But boredom doesn't kill you. More unequal countries are more exciting. London is exciting, right, for a bit. But then in London, unless you're somewhere near the top, it's a struggle. And even if you're near the top, when a standard three-bedroom house costs near to £1 million that's anywhere commutable, if you can't find that £1 million, it's still not fun. And even if you can find that £1 million, you've then got to work out which exclusive school you're going to send your children to, because everybody else you know is sending their children to an exclusive school. Carbon footprint. This is the thing that's really interesting. People appear to behave differently environmentally according to the level of economic inequality. And what matters most to us is health, and I'm talking to you about health, and what really matters for happiness is health. And the problem with saving the planet is that none of us can, well, some of us, but not many of us, look forward a few generations and say how terrible it is that we're burning up the planet. Whereas we do care about our health, for our parents, for our children's health. But for some reason, people in more equal countries and more equal states than the United States don't buy as much stuff they don't need, don't get as much advertising thrown at them, 4% of US GDP goes on advertising. 2% of UK GDP. Mainland Europe averages 1%. Advertising is all about trying to get you to buy something you don't want. That's the purpose of it. People eat less food in more equal countries. The most obese country in Europe, I'm demonstrating this now for you, is the UK. We're so paranoid about this that we spend so much money that we were number one for Olympic medals in Europe to make ourselves think we're fit, but we're the fattest. But thankfully, the United States of America, more unequal, even more obese, even more Olympic medals. I won't go on and on about it. Use of trains rather than flying, being able to cycle and walk to work rather than having to sit in the car in traffic jams. Just not wasting things, thinking carefully, wearing clothes again and again, buying fairly good quality clothes that are all black. Well, I noticed on the train station on the way here, everybody was in black. I'm glad you're not all in black. I don't know what it is about Switzerland, but anyway. But, you know, buying fairly good quality clothes that you can wear for a long time. Not cheap clothes that you wear once or twice and throw away. But people in more unequal countries do that. Here's a kind of summary of where we've got to with inequality. Hardly anybody is defending inequality at the moment. Where the arguments are about is it inequality or is it lack of trust? Occasionally you get really annoying arguments about racial homogeneity, but I'm happy to answer those. But essentially, countries with greater economic inequality, what background you come from begins to matter more and more. More equal countries, it doesn't. There were arguments about the mechanisms, arguments about the lags, arguments about the importance of material stuff versus psychosocial and psychological stuff. But nobody anymore is saying that inequality isn't bad. The final two graphs I want to show you, I think, need more work. This is not a good relationship. This isn't a particularly strong one. I haven't bothered to show you R squared because we don't have 20 planets, just one. But this is how well children do at maths about age 15 or 16 on the international PISA test versus inequality. And you'll see the UK and the US down here and other countries up here. But the reason why this graph fascinates me is that when you do the same test, almost exactly the same test, but people aged 24, which I guess is near your age, how many of you are 24, give me an idea? 23? No 23-year-olds? I'm looking out. 22? 25? 26? 27? 28? So that, okay, this is you, right. Someone else. That was you at 15, 16. This is you at 24 now. Now, okay, they line up partly, when you get something like this, it's chance, a little bit of chance, but not all chance. This is ability at maths. If I was to give you a maths test, the kind of maths test of 15 or 16 or gets now, compared to the same room of people the same age in UK, you, I'm guessing you're not all from Switzerland because you're fairly international, but you on average will do much better than the group in the UK. And by the way, our students in the UK, if they don't come from the UK, tend to come from unequal countries like the USA and Australia, because they come from countries where they're used to paying student fees and they don't realise they can go somewhere where they don't have to. Anyway. So the question is why? Here's one to end on for the question. Why is this relationship so much stronger at age 24 when nobody's been teaching you maths for 6-7 years? And the answer is that they taught you maths as children in a more equal country in a way that meant you actually learnt it. Whereas in UK and USA you teach maths, or they call it calculus in a sense. They teach maths to get the highest grade on the day. Because in an unequal country, your exam grades really matter, because you don't want a job at the bottom. And there's a huge difference between teaching to learn and teaching to get a grade. And what worries me about the country that I live in and I've grown up in is that we've become more and more a country where people can't do things because they actually haven't been taught how to do it, but they've all got A's. In particular, the university I'm teaching in Oxford, all our students have A's, lots of A's, all A stars. Nobody is allowed in with a single B. But that doesn't mean that they're all geniuses. But they don't know that. Cartoons are better than words. It's not good at the top in unequal countries. The fall is very big. You don't want to look down. Just falling a little bit down is not good. More equal countries always have a slope. I know they're not as happy and as nice as that, but that's to kind of give you an idea of how it happens. I would love to know how much inequality is too much equality. At the moment, the most equal countries in the world, Norway, Finland, and Japan, have the highest life expectancy, and it's still rising by a third of a year. So if you think life expectancy is a good measure, as yet, we haven't found out how much is too much equality. Thank you for putting up with me. Please ask me a question. We've got some mics, I think. Excuse me. One at the back.
Yeah, thank you very much. I have a question. Can you explain to me, like everything you said now, why did the whole of Europe take over an education system on university level from literally one of the worst countries in education? Like I see it now in university, everyone is just concerned about getting the points and the ECTS. Yeah. And I see that it doesn't really have a good effect because people don't study what they want to study, but just what gives them the most points and is the easiest to get a good grade.
Okay, this is a very good question. One problem with being from a more equal country is you tend to be more modest and less outgoing. If you think about how people from Japan behave, or people from Finland, we're stereotypes, but when compare them to Americans, or I find it hard to be that critical in my own country. The more unequal a country you come from, to get up and to do well, you have to put yourself forward and say how great you are. In fact, if you don't think you're great, you can't survive. There have been studies of Harlem that have shown that this is particularly high in America, in a poor part of America. You have to have this big self-belief. So when it comes to international education, us from the UK and the Americans said, you want to do it our way. We're the best in the world. Follow us. Your university is a lower ranking. We created ranking systems for universities that made us look good, that put us atop. Oxford is officially the world's number one university by the way it's measured, which you can easily critique and deconstruct if you try and do it. But people believe the rankings. Now, one way in which Oxford becomes world number one is we simply import people with very good CVs. The cost of housing is so high that if any of you take a job in Oxford, you'll probably leave within 3 years. But we have your CV for 3 years. And when you go, somebody else comes. That doesn't make a brilliant working environment, but it looks good at just one snapshot. It's not the only reason. The Americans were into ranking universities even earlier. And again, they buy in people for some of their universities. And they say, this is great, but in fact, the people did their work elsewhere. They come in late in life. You can go to US universities where they have flags showing you how many Nobel Prize winners they have, which are all brought in after they've got their Peace Prize, long after they've done their work. The problem is that you don't have super confident people in more equal countries who realise the advantage of their greater equality. What you tend to get in more equal countries are people saying, there are still problems here. How can you come here and say that this is great just because you come from somewhere bad? I'll make my other answer shorter if this matters. So I once went to Norway and I started the talk by saying congratulations on having the lowest child poverty rate in the world. And the audience shouted out, it's far too high, how can you say that? Which is why they have the lowest rate in the world. The problem is that
you've come to believe what the Americans and the British said. A particular economist working for PISA is a particular free marketeer who's managed to push you some of his ideas. This will have to be exposed and ended. Trump University failing was one of the beginnings of that. On average, private US universities spend more money on marketing than on teaching. Yeah? A university should be a university of a town or a city. It should mainly cater for people from that area, the town and the city. But it should also bring in people from outside to make it more interesting and varied, and then it does better. The idea of ranking universities is stupid. The idea of ranking universities is stupid. A university should be a university for a town or a city. The city I come from used to have a second university. It's called Oxford Polytechnic. It now only takes children with AA1B. So children growing up in my city have no university they can go to for the vast majority of the children of Oxford. That isn't seen as a problem by other universities because the universities are ever so successful. That's the kind of mess you get into when you leave this. I do think this will be unraveled. People make mistakes. This is a big mistake across Europe. The good side of it is the idea that you can move between universities in Europe. You can take your points with you. If you want to spend your second year somewhere else, you can do that. And the other good side is that you haven't yet believed us when we tried to tell you that our fee system is wonderful. £9,250 a year, that's a great idea. Debts of £50,000 to £100,000. We've only had this since 2012 in the UK. It is an absolute disaster. An unbelievable disaster. Luckily, we have the main opposition party promising that within a few days of their election, they will abolish this for all future students. It's in the manifesto, it'll go. We'll be down to zero fees. So we recognise that we've made a problem. That government has to come to power, and that government actually has to carry out its promise. And that isn't that hard, because the amount of money is £9 billion, and that's tiny compared to health spending. Or put it another way, that on that graph I showed you, the difference between the Labour and the Tory manifestos is 1% spending. Right? You've still got a long way to get up to France or Germany, let alone Finland. All the arguments of British politics are about spending 1% more GDP, of which higher education spending is a tiny fraction. I promise my next answer will be really short. Question?
Thank you. I was just wondering if you could say maybe a little bit more about why you chose to look at the 1% rather than the top 10%.
Okay. Some of those graphs I showed you are about the top 10% and the rest and the bottom 10%. I'll give you the UK stats again. In the UK, the top 10% take 28% of all income, which is the highest proportion of the top 10% anywhere in Europe, 28. And that only leaves 72% for the rest. So if you like, the other 90% of England are living in a country at 72% of GDP. Now, the crucial thing is, of that 28%, and I'm in the 10%, I'll be honest with you, I'm in the 3%. The 3% is the entire professorial pay band in the UK. So I'm not giving anything away, but I'm with 3%. The top 10% in the UK take 28% of all income. The top 1% take 14%, exactly half of that. So my group are taking 14%. And we're 9%. 10% minus 1%. Now remember, your math is really good. Right, so you can do this. I can't do this in the UK because I've lost you by now. But your math is good. So, you can complain about the top 10% taking 28%, but the reason they do is because the top 1% are taking so much. So it's when you concentrate on the 1% that you see where the real waste is. This 14%, that is 14% of, in effect, GDP. This is all wages. It's not quite the same, but it's similar. So if our top 1% were to take the same as in Switzerland,
that would free up 7% of GDP. Seven times the entire argument between Labour and the Conservatives for that budget. The amount of things you could do with that 7%. And when you look at individual countries, it's that 1% proportion gives you a better idea of something going wrong than the overall 10%. It's also wasted in that a lot of that money goes on housing prices. So when the 1% get more and more, when they take more, they end up competing with each other to buy particularly expensive housing, and the housing inflation rises. If you can get the 1% down, everybody else, by definition, has to drop down. So you concentrate on those salaries. It's people earning over £160,000. I keep on forgetting how much it is in euros because the pound keeps on dropping. But actually, very soon it'll be €160,000. Then we can join the euro. Another question? One about health? Or?
I would like to know if it's about politics or it's about a culture. You said in Japan maybe it's not just a culture choice. This inequality is less in Japan, but I wonder if it's as well, how can I say that? The people want that too.
Yeah.
People accept this situation.
Yeah. Is it a political choice rather than... That's a very good question. So we know that a big change occurred with the war. And the same with Germany. Germany was made the fastest way to become an equal country is to lose a war. It's also, so Switzerland's done very well without having lost a war for a long time. And the other thing that makes you more equal is being invaded. Actually just having the tanks go over and back again makes you behave in different ways to countries that aren't. Japan has been led by fairly conservative governments. But only conservative from a Japanese perspective. When people describe politicians as conservative or left in different countries, it tends not to be comparable. In that conservatives in more equal countries tend to be left-wing. We just don't... Angela Merkel, from a British point of view, is more left-wing than Labour over the policy she actually does. Tony Blair was more right-wing than Margaret Thatcher. As our politics moved to the right, he had higher tax breaks for the rich than Margaret Thatcher had. The Conservative Party in the UK was so far to the right that it had to join the Polish Law and Justice Party in the European Parliament because it couldn't get on with the other Conservative parties of Europe. And the reason we're saying this is that in Japan it's the same thing. We often talk about it being the Conservative government, but it's a government which doesn't behave like other Conservative governments. There's a claim made by Owen Jones that there's one skyscraper in Canary Wharf in London that has more people earning over €1 million a year than the whole of Japan. And that's what I mean about the 1%. If you just do not have a section of people who are paid an enormous amount of money, it changes what you do. It's hard to say. I've already been to Japan four or five times. I'm obsessed about it because it's the most equal and I look at lots of numbers. I try to imagine Japan as a bit like what would have happened to England if England had been invaded and completely lost the Second World War. And if the families who've owned land in England for 1,000 years, since William the Conqueror gave them that land in 1066, had land taken off them. And if the Queen, well, the Emperor was kept, but if you know, you can imagine. And it's hard to imagine the country I come from having been changed that much. Other things matter. Having only one child, which is now normal in Tokyo and has been for a long time, fertility rates of 1.3, mean it makes sense to have a society that looks after each other because you can't rely on your family to look after you because your family becomes so very narrow and small. So that will play a part. It also has to be said that Japan is not particularly nice to the bottom 1%. Unless all your family will write a letter disowning you, you do not qualify for social security payments. So you see homeless people in blue tents in Japan. Not many, very neat blue tent, a blue tent with a bicycle next to it, a bicycle that isn't locked, because even in the poorest part of Japan you don't have to lock bicycles. But still people who've been left. So it's not a utopia. But it's created a new kind of way of thinking that's similar to Norway. It's the geographical analogies that help you sort of see what isn't specific to the place. A colleague recently told me in Norway, went to live in Norway for a year, and they had a child who's age 6, and the child went to school. And one day, without any warning, the entire class, all the children, turned up at her door. Because in the first few weeks at school, all the children go and visit everybody else's home so they can see where they're from. And they don't bother telling the parents, because why should they? Now, that's the behaviour of a society that's become very equal, that doesn't see family as all important, but sees something else as important. It's not communist, it is not imposed, it's something that's growing and changing. But you don't have the idea that we have in Britain, that basically if you don't work hard enough, that's it, you don't deserve much. And we have shirkers and skivers who are lazy and we shouldn't be paying them benefits and so on. And the children who do best at school are obviously the really clever children, and they should get more because they're so clever. That kind of way of thinking that's common in my country is not. So it's a rambling answer. I think we're very lucky that we have a series of countries that are so separated around the world but have similar levels of equality. Because otherwise we would say, well, that's the special Norwegian thing that Norwegians do because they're Viking. And we, you know, and then we did the same with the Japanese and we stereotype them because they're Japanese. But the fascinating thing. And the same for, you know, Portugal, Singapore, USA and the UK. You know, these are four very different places. But Portugal had an aristocracy. Singapore happened to geographically be in the right place in the world to make a lot of money from boats. But then something else happened. And it also has a particularly rigid ethnic division within it, which allows it to carry on. Israel, which I hardly ever talk about. But Israel will be the fifth one you'd add to those unequal countries. And the interesting thing about doing that, I'm always very aware about talking about Israel, but you could ask how much of Israel's problems are actually inequality which is justified and allowed because of other things. And if it didn't have that inequality, would people get on better with each other in Israel? The opposite country to Israel is Iceland, which is a genetic mix of slavers and their slaves, Celts and Vikings. But Iceland has very low economic inequality, so nobody knows who's a Celt and who's a Viking. Because you can't keep those ethnic differences going when you don't treat people differently economically. Just past 6, is there another question? Won't keep you too long. Make it a last one. There's one down here.
Thank you very much. You saw these important measures of economic development and their association with inequalities and health inequalities most particularly. I would like a short comment on the indicator of GDP growth rate, and maybe from your experience in conducting research in upper middle income countries or the BRICS, Brazil, the example of Brazil, India, Australia has the highest GDP growth rate among developed nations, and still they're faced with important challenges with regards to health inequalities. But India, and particularly Turkey, I believe, are examples where we see, for example, Turkey has improved significantly, and China also, but India not so much in terms of health outcomes, despite the high GDP growth rate that they have experienced and seen in the last years.
Okay. I should have said something about the other 175 countries in the world, not the richest 25. But this evidence works best for the richest 25. Because if you're not in the richest 25, the best thing you can still do is get a little bit richer. The interesting thing about the richest 25 is we've now got to a point where it appears to me that getting richer doesn't make you better off. OECD have done work on GDP growth rates and inequality, which suggests that GDP growth is curtailed by inequality on average. Growth tends to be higher in countries that are more equal. France is, I've forgotten, it's 20% more productive than the UK. Why are countries more productive? Because people work harder when they're not so badly paid at lots of jobs. And people who are very well paid, take your bankers. The British banker is not working twice as hard as the Swiss banker. You know, the Swiss banker is still working 12 hours a day, fairly well paid. The British banker might be working 13 hours a day. That isn't twice as much, and it probably makes them worse at being a banker because they get more tired. An important thing about GDP growth, and what's just beginning to measure this, what you really want is high GDP growth with reduced pollution. And that's possible, so green GDP growth. And that is definitely stronger in more equal countries because people think about it more and they're concerned about it more. For the other 175 countries in the world, China's had the longest sustained record in almost human history. And it's stunning. Urban China now has lower infant mortality than rural USA. So if you had to choose, suppose you're going to be born again tomorrow, and you've got two choices, rural USA or urban China, you want to choose urban China. And that's just happened. Australia does it on coal and uranium, and being near to China, near enough. And it's like Singapore, you know, there are always geographical advantages. But in general, the poorer countries that have done better have been the more equal ones. Brazil is a hell of a mess still. I've only been to Brazil once and like five times to Japan. Geographers are allowed to travel, but then I feel guilty about the carbon because our job title is geographer. But when I went to Rio, I spent 3 days in Rio, and everybody had their backpack on their front. Nobody ever had their backpack behind them. And that's scary if you think the whole population always thinking about being pickpocketed. In Copacabana, but even outside there. And I asked somebody, there are bars on every window. This is an affluent part of Rio de Janeiro. And I asked my friends from the Government Statistical Institute, who I want to talk to about inequality, I said, why are there bars everywhere? And she said, because we like to drink. And I realised that she didn't understand the question, because she'd become so used to the bars that she didn't see them anymore. It's only been the last 30 years that the world has kind of divided in this way, and it's almost been partly by accident that it's done so. And if it hadn't divided, we'd never have known. That's interesting. But now that we know, our biggest problem is that people from more equal countries are modest and quiet and don't want to say what's good about their country. And if asked, the classic one about modesty, you improve it, is I want to ask you if you're a better driver than average, or if you're better looking than average, or if you're clever than average. But you can imagine what proportion of people in the USA answer yes to those questions. And in more equal countries, it heads towards 50%. And the only problem with being normal and equal and realising that none of you are that special is that then nobody steps forward and says you want to be like this. Because, you know, why should I step forward? I'm not that special. Whereas in an unequal country, you get people who go, yeah, I was made by God to lead you, and I never make a mistake, and I am superhumanly able. And this, I don't know how we get over this one, but part of the reason why things have got so bad is that problem. But when things get this bad, and the evidence gets so bad, and infant mortality is rising in the UK now. For the first time since the war, infant mortality is rising. It's been rising for a few years in the USA. So what happens when Europeans can't work this out is the statistics become more and more and more obvious. And then at some point, you have to just say you do not want to learn lessons from places that have got it so very, very wrong. Thank you for your patience. Let me go over time. Thank you.